House Judiciary on Crime. Hearing date, January the 13th, 1989. Hearing room 357, 1 p.m.
January 13th, 1989 meeting of the House Committee and Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Law and Corrections has come to order. Our agenda today includes House Bill 2250 relating to police stops, House Bill 2251 relating to joinder of offenses, and House Bill 2252 relating to certain surveillance devices. I'm going to try to go in our usual order of working today, and I'm waiting for the witness list to come up.
Delete the door.
This is always a real dilemma because when I have other legislative members in the audience and members of the judiciary in the audience, who we go first. But I think I'm going to start out with Representative Burton and Senator Phillips. I think they want to do kind of a two-party song and dance, soft shoe on some of these matters here. And then we'll move on and start in a second. For those of you who are new to this particular subcommittee, let me introduce some of our members. On my far right is Representative Minnis. Not quite so far to the right is Representative Bryan. Representative Baum,
is it a
Representative
comment?
Miller, Committee Counsel Joellen Zucker, Representative Courtney, Representative Calori, and on the far left, Representative Manick.
It's appropriate.
Amazing how it worked that way. So without further ado, and if we can get those witness lists up to me, why don't we start with Representative Burton. Representative Burton and Senator Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tell us what bill you're on. And
well, for the record, my name is Mike Burton, State Representative District 17 in Portland, and we're here really to just very generally discuss the joinder, the body wire, and the crime stop bills, and just to voice our support for those. And I'm not certain of the bill numbers, but I would like to congratulate the committee on its new committee room. It's a little bright in here. I don't know if it's just the newness of all this. Maybe after we've sort of rubbed the furniture a little while here, it'll sort of tone this down. And I will be watching this committee to see if the vote comes out in the seating order. So I appreciate that. I'm here really today as co-chair of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon, which is a group that got started about a year ago, primarily aimed to counter the marijuana initiative, which was about to be placed on the ballot again, and also to further take a look at strengthening some of our drug laws in this state. We were successful, we feel, in keeping the marijuana initiative off the ballot, and we adopted a 14-point program, which three of which bills are going to be in front of you today concerning, as I mentioned, joinder, the body wire for narcotics cases, and the crime prevention stop bill. And there are other bills in our portfolio which will be introduced probably later, and we would ask, Mr. Chairman, if when some of those bills are coming up, we have two of the other members of our executive group, our Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schrunk and the U.S. Attorney Charles Turner, and would like to ask you, if you would, to invite them down for testimony on those other bills. I would just simply say this. These are three bills which I dealt with in the last legislative session. I think some of you on this committee have seen these before. They did pass the out of the committee successfully in past sessions and have successfully passed the House of Representatives. So these are not necessarily, it's not necessarily new legislation. And you may ask yourself, why am I seeing them again? I think in the last instance it was because they somehow failed to get movement in the Senate. And hopefully my co-chair here to my left, Senator Phillips now, will help deal with that issue over there. I would really encourage you to move these bills very rapidly and appreciate you having these early hearings on them.
Questions of Representative Burton?
Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Simply observe for Representative Burton, this room is bright for having been our caucus room for so many years.
Oh, jeez. You got to put up with that stuff.
That is.
Yeah,
again.
Did it look this good before?
No, don't respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Paul Phillips, State Senator from Tigard, co-chair of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. When we have an opportunity to make a presentation with the others, perhaps I'll share then. Other than that, I endorse wholeheartedly what Representative Burton said and look for your fast action on these important bills. Thank you.
And for your information, the U.S. Attorney and the Multnomah County District Attorney can come and testify any time they want.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I'm going to start in the order the bills are presented, with two exceptions. On I'm going to start with 2250, and I always like to move our members of the judiciary, get them back to work. So Judge Snoffer, I'm going to call him on 2250, and as kind of a courtesy in getting back to work.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I apologize really to the committee. My name, first of all, William Snoffer. I'm a circuit judge, Multnomah County. I'm here strictly representing myself on this particular bill. I apologize that I really didn't learn about the bill until yesterday morning and was busy all day and really didn't have time to prepare any written testimony as such. What I did do is prepare a brief list of about a dozen cases that have been decided by the Oregon appellate courts interpreting ORS 131.615 as it presently exists, and I did not know how many people are on the committee. I had prepared 10 copies of these cases, and one I need for my own use, and I have 9 that I would like to hand up to the staff, perhaps to circulate among the committee. But let me just kind of extemporaneously say that as I understand House Bill 2250 is presently drafted, what it seeks to do is put language back into the statute that was originally proposed to the legislature in 1973 as part of the Criminal Law Revision Commission. And the original purpose, if one were to go back and look at the Criminal Law Revision Commission notes with regard to the proposed code at that time, would indicate to you that this statute, as you see it in front of you this morning, this afternoon, was designed to codify Terry versus Ohio. I apologize, I was not able to do any legal research on this, but short of it is that the legislature deleted the 4 or 5 words that you see in the bill, and the appellate courts, starting about 75 or 76, when lawyers and judges began to understand the significance of this language, started writing opinions that, in my judgment, are very restrictive, pointing out that the ORS 131.615 is more restrictive than Terry versus Ohio. It does not allow police to interrogate somebody whom they believe is about to commit a crime. This language, I think, is sought to be reinserted back into the statute to make Oregon law conform to Terry versus Ohio, and the case has been decided under Terry versus Ohio. And what I've presented to you is a series of 12 cases, very briefly summarized, which, in my judgment, really unrealistically restrict the police from asking appropriate questions of people who may have stopped for one reason or another and suspect to be criminally involved in various activities. And if you read the cases in some detail, I think you'd see that the court is essentially saying, well, the statute as it's presently written restricts the police on the extent of their interrogation of people whom they stopped, and so they, adopting the statutory language, have, in my opinion, unreasonably restricted the police. This bill seeks to conform to Terry versus Ohio, bring state law back into conformity with Terry versus Ohio, and I think, in all respects, it's a good bill not to be adopted.
For the record, we'll enter into the record a document submitted by Judge Snoffer. The document does not have a date on the top of it, but the first line is a man walking an alley at 3 a.m., so that'll be identify the document. The document is a series of cases that Judge Snoffer has cited regarding the particular statute, ORS 131.615. Also, for the record, we might cite a further case. I don't think you cite Valdez.
No, I haven't cited.
You might cite, for the record, you might cite State versus Valdez. I'm having a hard time reading my Xerox copy here. 561 Pacific 2nd, 1006. So just for the record there. Judge Snoffer, just some perhaps somewhat esoteric point. Terry was we law school. We all know Terry is stop and frisk. Is there any subtle distinction there? And on the frisk aspect, is that involved here at all?
I don't think so. The frisk statutes are not addressed by this piece of legislation. There certainly is some interrelationship, and to the extent that the officer by this bill would be allowed to stop somebody whom he or she is presently not able to stop, that might then lead to a frisk situation. So this might trigger a frisk where normally a frisk might not occur, but not because of this bill. This bill, the frisk statutes, the definition of a frisk, the scope of a frisk, et cetera, is defined by other statutes.
Okay, I want to clarify. Thank you very much. Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one question about these cases. Did each of these cases involve an actual court interpretation and application of ORS 131615?
To the best of my ability and about an hour's worth of research this morning, yes, they do.
And I understand the limitations.
Limited strictly to the statutes.
And they weren't getting into constitutional principles?
No.
Thank you.
That's the interesting aspect here is we're not talking constitution, we're talking federal limit, Terry, but we're not. The limitation here is that a statutory limitation what the police can or cannot do. Further questions of Judge Snoffer?
This amendment would extend the statute to track Terry versus Ohio and the constitutional parameters.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I'm going to take one other person out of order. I'm going to ask Ms. Streisinger on 2251. We like to get you away, you see, so we can
keep me out of trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Corey Streisinger, lead counsel to Governor Goldschmidt, and I'm pleased to be here today to offer the governor's support for House Bill 2251, which provides for the joinder of multiple offenses in a single trial. This bill appears on the governor's priority list of crime-fighting measures, and I know it's a top priority for many other law enforcement officials as well. Under current law, an offender who commits multiple similar crimes, for example, a string of several dozen residential burglaries, must be tried separately for each offense. By permitting these offenses to be tried together, House Bill 2251 would assist the functioning of the criminal justice system in several ways. Other witnesses, I'm sure, will be explaining a number of them. I'd just like to mention a couple of examples. The first one is that joint trials could potentially, and I do say potentially since figures aren't available, result in considerable savings to the criminal justice system. The topmost example probably is in indigent defense, an area where I'm sure you will all be spending a great deal of time in the next few months. And although counsel for an indigent accused would obviously have to prepare separately for each offense, even if this bill were adopted, the cost of the trial itself would be incurred only once. Other parts of the system are at least likely to experience cost savings as well. The clogged court dockets that many counties now experience might receive some relief if this bill were adopted, and of course, prosecution costs connected with multiple trials might be reduced as well. Second, enactment of a joinder law will make for more accurate criminal histories, which will in turn enable us to identify serious offenders more accurately. That's particularly important in these times of scarce correctional resources, when much of our effort is geared toward making sure that prison space and other correctional resources are used to control those offenders who present the greatest threat to the public. And frequently, we use criminal histories to determine the degree of threat. Under the current parole matrix, for example, the number of prior convictions on a felon's record play a major part in determining the actual length of prison term imposed for a new crime. Criminal history will play an even larger role under the proposed sentencing guidelines. And we have additional resources, such as the newly created Parole Violators Project at work in Coos County, the Structured Supervision Project in Multnomah County, which also are aimed specifically toward criminals with particular high-volume criminal profiles. Without a joinder law, though, the criminal records of many of these high-volume offenders will remain artificially sanitary. If an offender, for example, supports a drug habit through a series of burglaries or car prowls, perhaps at the rate of dozens a month, which is not unusual, separate trials on each offense are obviously impossible. I'm sure you'll have prosecutors here to describe the phenomenon, but our understanding is that frequently prosecutors simply pick one or two or perhaps three of the offenses, try the offender on those, and forget the rest. The result is that we lose our ability to identify the high-volume criminal, and we may fail to treat them with the severity which, in fact, their history means that they should be treated. Obviously, neither of these rationales would be sufficient to justify joinder in cases where it resulted in prejudice to the defendant. But House Bill 2251 provides for severability where either party would be prejudiced by joinder. This is a subject on which I'm sure you'll hear debate today. However, this is identical, I believe, to the federal bill, and the federal courts have a fair amount of case law in existence on what constitutes prejudice. The experience in the federal courts and in many other states which have this bill shows that juries are, in fact, fully capable in most cases of judging each charge separately in a joint trial. For these reasons, the governor urges your support of this bill. I'll be pleased to answer any questions that I can.
Questions of Ms. Streisinger?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to now go back to 2250. And by the way, Mr. Penn just came in. The witness lists are up here. So Mr. Penn, what are you here on so I can put you on the bottom of the list? What?
On all three.
On all three.
Okay, shouldn't have asked.
Yes, can we have joinder on that?
Okay.
5:30.
John Reichel, the Clackamas County Sheriff, on House Bill 2250.
North of Revere. Lots of county.
Bye.
Thank you. I would just like to briefly state a support for this bill here. We train our officers or deputies to recognize those activities of offenders or potential offenders. And for us to be active in a proactive or a crime prevention type manner, we have to give our officers the tools to be able to follow through with that. If our officers see a suspicious circumstance involving one or more suspects and they are unable to make contact with them because it's prohibited, then we defeat our own purpose in some of the training that they receive. The outcome of this, if this bill is favorably approved, is that our officers will be able to make more contacts with people in suspicious areas at suspicious time of day, record that information. A person who has been contacted who is a potential offender would not be as likely to go ahead and commit that crime if he feels that he's safe a few days later down the road and he's in the same area and again going to try to commit a crime. There may be a record or a contact for law enforcement to pursue that and make an investigation. Real briefly, I don't feel that this the negative side of this bill would have much of an impact on the law-abiding public. Our experience has been that if we see somebody closing up a warehouse or hanging around a warehouse late at night and he has a legitimate reason to be there and you make contact with them, they generally appreciate the inquisitive nature of the law enforcement officer. Any citizen who is detained who is not out there violating a law, it's just a brief detention period and he's allowed to go on his way. The negative impact of this is very slight, and I think this would be really beneficial to law enforcement.
Questions of the officer. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Walter Todd, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Todd.
Thank you. Mr. Todd from Salem. I'm a criminal defense lawyer here, and I have been so for about 7 years and spent 2 years in the DA's office before that. The OCDLA would like to go on record as opposed to this bill. The reason that this has been looked at, first of all, in historical perspective, as Judge Snoffer, did I correctly pronounce his name?
Yes, Snoffer. You did, Judge Snoffer.
As he indicated, it was looked at in 1973 and rejected by the legislature. The more restrictive standard, the federal standard, was examined then, rejected, and this, in fact, has been cited, State versus Brown, 31 ORAP 501, 1977 case. the courts recognize that that's exactly what happened. The legislative body made a decision to have a more restrictive standard so that individuals would be protected to a higher level from unreasonable stops or unnecessary stops than the federal standard. There has to be some sort of reason given, I think, to change that and follow the more restrictive standard. And I'm not certain, and I apologize, just as Judge Snopper did, as far as written testimony or case law research, but I would like to see the 12 cases and perhaps submit a memo on behalf of the OCDLA. I would wonder how many of those cases would have been resolved differently under this more restrictive standard. There may be other reasons. For example, the issue might have been, was there in fact a stop? Or, in fact, was it just mere conversation between the officer, that sort of thing? Basic position is that it's going to allow police officers to have more of a gut feeling that an offense is about to be committed. And if that's the standard that we're going to go to, then I think we ought to call it that and recognize it as that. That's all I have.
Questions of Mr. Todd, Representative Minnis.
Mr. Todd. As a criminal trial lawyer, you oftentimes cross-examine police officers in court. In your cross-examination of a police officer in court, when they're trying to explain a reason for a stop, even under the existing law, don't you often ask them how they've articulated those facts and upon, you know, how they've built that probable cause or reasonable suspicion?
That's correct. The case law is that the officer has to be able to specifically articulate objective reasons for his subjective determination that there was a reasonable suspicion.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, additional question. So wouldn't it follow then by that same logic that a police officer could not use their gut level feeling?
I see your argument, and that's true. There would be a whole body of case law then that would have to be initiated to determine what specific objectionable or objective facts or articulable facts would qualify as a reasonable suspicion for this aspect of it. And assuming that that all occurred, there would eventually be a definition of it.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Todd, if I understood you said that you think there's a good reason for having a higher level of protection than the federal law requires. Can you explain that to me?
I think, and again, I don't have the specifics as far as the different standards that Oregon has in various areas, but there are several areas of law that the Oregon courts and the legislative bodies have decided that Oregon should have a more restrictive interpretation. I think the roadblock situation is one, but again, I'm not familiar with that off the top of my head. And I think the reason for that is the Oregon position in the past that their citizens should have high levels of protection under the Oregon Constitution, and that certain amendments and articles in the Constitution guarantee Oregon citizens more protection from unreasonable stops, searches and seizures, that sort of thing.
Further, Representative Minnis.
Thank you.
Armin Mannix.
Thank you.
It's going to happen a lot, I know.
Now, let me get this straight. We're going to make a distinction here, aren't we, between constitutional standards and statutory standards. We don't have in front of us a bill that's amending the Constitution of the State of Oregon. Let me ask you, in regard to this specific statute, you started talking about gut feeling. I don't see any language here that changes the articulable standards that the officer must be able to point to. The language that says a peace officer who reasonably suspects, that's still there. All we do is we add that he, instead of just suspecting that somebody already committed a crime, that if he suspects someone is about to commit a crime, if he can point to articulable standards, he can then inquire. Isn't that really all that the statute does?
That's true. The articulable standards, though, are going to have to be defined again by the courts. They're not going to be the same. For example, there's a whole body of case law that says if you see someone weaving, that's an articulable standard. Well, now suppose the fellow's driving down the road and the officer has to come up with a reason why he thinks that individual is about to commit an offense and he's not weaving. Well, is weaving within the lane then? Is that going to be enough? I mean, there's going to be a whole series of cases that are going to have to define that, and it's going to be more cost. I think there has to be a reason to make that more restrictive standard to start with.
May I follow up with one more?
Yeah, and I might, for the record, we might cite that the phrase articulable is actually a Terry phrase
I happen to have it in front of me. When an officer observes unusual conduct which leads to him to reasonably to conclude in light of his experience that criminal activity is afoot, and when he is able to point to specific and articulable facts which give rise to the inference, which is the magic language that I think you're referring to.
Now, we're not backing away from that, as I understand it.
No.
We're just saying that he can also say, if I may use the goriest example that comes to mind, the officer sees a person standing there with a knife in his hand, and there's another person standing in front of the person with the knife, but the knife hasn't moved forward, as opposed to, so the officer thinks that a crime is about to be committed, i.e. assault, as opposed to standing there and seeing that the knife has already gone in and come back out, and there's blood on it, and the crime has just occurred. Isn't that about the most extreme example of the distinction?
Well, without more details, I'm not so sure that I could answer that, but I would assume the officer would still have a right in the situation that you've talked about to go up to those people, to confront those individuals, have at the very least a conversation with them without actually affecting a stop on those people and still stop the crime from occurring.
Thank you.
Further questions, Mr. Todd? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Will Hingston, Marion County Sheriff's.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Captain Will Hingston. I'm here today representing Sheriff Prinsloo, who was unable to attend, and the Oregon State Police, Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As a representative, I would like to offer their support and go on record as offering their support of House Bill 2250. We feel that it would offer the police officers an effective tool to be more preventive and proactive rather than reactive in the work that we do on the streets.
Questions to the officer? Thank you very much, sir. Stevie Remington? ACLU.
She's going to be a guest.
All right. Cast.
I dealt with it back.
Stevie Remington, American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. I'm here, top of my head, seat of my pants, to flag to you that we oppose enactment of this bill. And I have a promise from Mark Blackman that in a short while he will draft a memorandum which I can submit to you. I gather he's getting ready for a CLE on this subject and has a bunch of cases and wants to talk about it. We are concerned. We've been supporting that standard since 1973, and I was a participant as a lobbyist in the criminal code revision, and we'd like to see you stick to it. I would like to comment that one of the things we're concerned about is the opening up of broader discretion on the police officers. We think is subject to abuse by some people, and for instance, some of the things I'm concerned about is whether a black person at midnight in a white suburb is reason to suspect that they might be about to commit a crime, or whether you see a very old beat-up car in an affluent suburb, whether that in itself is reason to suspect that you're about to commit a crime. And I would like to call attention to the fact that an attempt to commit a crime is covered under the current statute, and I think many of the same facts that are reasonable, give rise to reasonable suspicion, you don't have to say it's about to commit a crime, but they are engaged in attempting a crime and it would survive. Anyway, I do expect to have a memorandum for you in the very near future, and I am not an attorney. I want to deny any association with that group, and I can't give legal advice, and I will have some experts on this.
These disclaimers are painful. Any questions of Ms. Remington? Starting on my far right.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question I perhaps the legislative council staff or legislative staff can answer. Are there cases on the federal level relevant to Terry versus Ohio that speak to the issues that Ms. Remington just spoke about
Probably
regarding
Legion.
A black individual in a white
Legion, tremendous number.
Okay, so that issue's already...
In fact, that particular facts is a use site or a subject of a case.
What is the... You happen to remember...
I think the bottom line result was they couldn't do it. They couldn't stop the black man from walking in a white neighborhood.
Yeah, even no, under Terry.
I'm thinking of one which
even
is...
Even under federal law. Yeah.
Okay. This was, I think, an ACLU case, at least one, where this was a person who lived in the neighborhood and was jogging and had a hairdo with braids and so on and was repeatedly stopped.
Well, we appreciate that concern, but I think that case disposed of.
Well, for the record, you might cite that under we adopt the Terry interpretation, to a great extent, we had to be adopting by inference some of that federal case law, and that case law, as Representative Baum so graciously pointed out, addresses that particular situation. Anything further? Representative Miller.
I just question about the crummy car in the nice neighborhood.
This is your district?
It is a nice neighborhood, yes. Do you think that the appearance of the crummy car is in itself reason to make a stop?
No.
Do you then have no confidence in a police officer's ability to reach that same conclusion?
Not solely on that basis. In fact, one of the cases that we won many years ago.
Offender. That requires a significant crime background to qualify for that label. Of those, approximately a third have been identified as being currently active in our area. So we have a number of multiple offenders in all different crime categories that all of the research indicates that the number one impact you can have on the repeat offender is to incapacitate that individual, and our ability to bring multiple charges in a single instance would be a great benefit to that program.
Thank you.
Representative Floyd, do you have a question?
Mr. Mann, you brought up the subject about the fiscal impact of testifying in multiple trials. I guess I'm going to assume that most police agencies are organized, have union contracts. Can you give us an idea, either from your general knowledge or at least from in your own particular area, about how that works? You know, if you testify for 30 minutes, do you have to pay him for 8 hours or,
typically,
you know, all that
union
kind of
contract
stuff?
Will have a minimum. So in our department, if it's your duty day, it'll be a two-hour minimum. If it's your day off, it's a three-hour minimum. And that depends on how long you're actually in trial. Actually, the worst effect is that we see officers, particularly working late nights, they will spend all day in trial and then be expected to work the next day or work that night.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Dale Penn?
We have much documentation.
Should we include that now?
Yeah. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. First thing I would like to say is that this bill basically in its present form passed the House last session on a vote of 48-1. It did not receive, or it received a hearing at the last minute in the Senate, but it was not seriously considered at the time. We believe that the Oregon system, which presently, in simplistic language, allows the defendant to choose which cases will be tried at which time. In other words, any cases that arise out of against a defendant, the defendant has the choice under Oregon law. That is directly opposite federal law, where the presumption is that all cases will be joined together unless there is specific prejudice shown. And we believe that is a much more efficient manner of handling the courts and a court system that is overworked and extremely in debt. We believe it is high case or cost savings. If you look at one handout that I just gave, I used Marion County statistics because I have good access to those. And I identified approximately 45% of our felony caseload that would have come under this statute that would have allowed us to join them. If you allow the present system to go into to stay in effect, or as Mr. Todd, I think, testified that he desired that the prosecution should have to move to consolidate, we are talking about hearings to do that and fighting about what gets separated, what does not. This rule says the presumption is they will be joined. You only have the hearing if there's specific prejudice shown to separate. With that observation, I would just also explain what these other handouts are. There is another handout that starts out, Federal Rule 8A deals with the permissive joinder of offenses. We would ask that you adopt this legislation, which is Federal Rule 8 of joinder and Federal Rule 14 of severance. The language looks pretty much the same as Oregon law now. However, we would ask that you adopt them, and in legislative history also adopt the Ninth Circuit interpretation of this joinder statute. And this memorandum is basically laying out the guidelines that the Ninth Circuit in the last 20 years has developed on what is specific prejudice that allows severance. If that step is taken, we believe there would be clear guidance for judicial interpretation of the statute in the future. The last handout I have is the Interim Committee fiscal analysis, which really isn't a lot of help.
So for the record, let's cite the handouts. First thing is a large packet with the title sheet, Oregon Law Review, Volume 66, Number 4. It not only has a law review article, it has several other articles, plus some newspaper articles. Then we have the State of Oregon Legislative Fiscal Office, July 20th, 1980, memorandum to the Interim Judiciary Committee from Ken Jones. And finally, and one we particularly will want to work with, the memo, but it's on the letterhead of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Mr. Penn's referred to it, and starts out with the phrase, Federal Rule 8A deals with permissive joinder, et cetera, et cetera. So we will get to that, especially I think we need to talk about the adoption of the Ninth Circuit case law if we eventually get to this. So, now we'll go on. Anything else?
I have nothing further. The law review article was written by Sean, and it gives a detailed analysis of Oregon joinder system and this legislation. I'd have no further comments. We would be very happy to answer questions. I believe Sean would have one suggestion of an amendment that we had a typographical error on, evidently.
You want to hold that until we work session this, Mr. Sean?
I could. I would also like to give you just a brief summary of the history. I should take probably no more than a minute.
Okay. A minute.
For the record, my name is Sean Hoare. I'm an assistant district attorney for the Lane County. And very briefly, when Oregon first began, we had this broad joinder. It was joinder of the same act and transaction, several acts or transactions that are related, as well as similar character offenses. The statute was then changed, and in 1933, the current offense, joinder of offense statute, allegedly a permissive joinder of offense statute, is the one that we have now. The judiciary has construed this to be the same as our compulsory joinder statute, which means joinder is not permitted unless it's compelled, which really doesn't make much sense. Briefly, broad joinder has been present in the federal system since 1853. It's as old as the common law. Currently, in terms of related offense joinder, 42 of the 47 states in America that have joinder statutes have related offense joinder statutes. 33 of the 47 states in the United States that have joinder statutes also have similar character offense joinder statutes. Oregon is one of the five most restrictive states in terms of its joinder statutes. I would refer you to, I guess, a law review article that I wrote, and that's the first exhibit you received. In that is a description of everything that supports this. The ABA Task Force, the American Bar Association Task Force, lists the advantages as well as the disadvantages of the various types of joinder, and it's set forth in my article. And I would just point out that the ABA is not overwhelmed with prosecutors. In fact, there are far more defense attorneys in the ABA than there are prosecutors.
and yet this is one area where it appears as though there is some common sense used in the analysis for statutory schemes outside the state of Oregon, and there is broad support for broad joinder. And I would just encourage you to review those exhibits and encourage you to adopt it. My suggestion with regard to the amendment is that the statute as written actually only refers to felony offenses, and it should state accusatory instrument as opposed to the same indictment or information, because in district court cases, we file cases based upon a complaint as opposed to an indictment or information. So I would merely suggest that the statute as proposed would read two or more offenses may be charged in the same accusatory instrument as opposed to the same indictment or information. And that would include all your felonies and misdemeanors if you saw fit to pass this.
Do you have the bill in front of you?
I do.
What line? Give me a line. Okay. Side,
it would be line 14 and 15. The words in the same indictment or information, I would propose that that be stricken, and the words in the same accusatory instrument.
Mr. Chairman, it's line 11 on the bill.
Line 11.
Oh, excuse me.
He said 14 and 15.
He has the LC draft. We don't have a copy of the
line 11.
Line 11.
So you would propose accusatory instrument. Okay, we'll flag that for anything further?
In terms of, well, I have a fiscal statement, but I'm sure you'll pursue that in your work session.
Mr. Penn, why don't you just hit 2252 while you're there?
Okay. I left my little notes back at my seat, but 2252, again, my name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, but that is our attempt to deal with body wire devices in drug cases. This bill passed the House last session 47-2, and it was not given a hearing in the Senate. This restores pre-1985 law, which stated that in narcotics offenses, police officers, when you're talking about a body wire, which is in typically a drug sale situation where you would send another officer in to make a buy, or when you send an informant in to make a buy, in that investigation you would put a listening device on the body of that informant or police officer, send him in to make that buy, and it would allow other officers to be able to listen to what is happening so that if there is a dangerous situation, the other officers could go in and rescue that agent. In this county, unfortunately, in the last 6 months, we've had two shootings in similar incidents. These are very dangerous kind of investigative activity. Presently, it requires that there be a court order to get a body wire authorization. We believe that the pre-85 law should be utilized because typically sales transactions happen very quickly, where an officer may receive information from an informant that a buy would happen now, or the buy is going to change and be in a different time, a different location. What happens is, presently, many officers do not have the time to get the court order. They don't use the body wire now. It's a straight officer safety situation. Because of that, we believe it's appropriate to go back to 1985 law and allow the officer to obtain the order or to use the listening device without the pre-approval of the court order. That's the basis for the statute.
Bren?
I have nothing further on it.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of them on this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, one question. Mr. Penn.
Don't leave.
Were you involved in the drafting of this legislation? Did I hear you right?
Yes.
I have one question with reference to the definition here. On line 20 and line 24, it talks about direct supervision. Someone under the direct supervision of an officer, which I'm construing that to be an informant or someone that you're working with confidentially and reliably. What's the definition of, or how are we deriving a definition for direct supervision?
It is not defined. The intent is that it would deal specifically with someone that would be working on a case, but he's not a police officer, and so you're going to send him in to make a buy. That's the intent. If there was any thought that it needs to be defined, we would be very happy to do so.
Mr. Chairman.
That was my understanding.
Mr. Penn, I guess for a point of clarification, I guess I was concerned that if you sent an informant into a house to do a drug buy, that if he wasn't in your line of sight or observation, perhaps that would not be direct supervision and create some problems.
Mr. Chair, Representative Menace, the only comment I'd have is that if the statute was passed as amended, then we would have a listening device, and I would be arguing that being able to listen to what's going on is direct supervision. But we'd be happy to prepare an amendment if you felt that was necessary.
If I might, you have a question on this bill. I've got to shift back for a moment. Representative Mannix.
On House Bill 2252, why are we limiting this broadening to felonies?
We believe that it's most important in narcotics cases, and we didn't want to make it controversial, or at least the least controversial as possible, to at least obtain that ability. Historically, what happened was pre-1985, this was available for narcotics offenses alone. We had real problems in thefts and burglary rings where you'd have sales of stolen property, and we came forward with a statute that would allow body wires in other kinds of cases. It was amended, went through, at the last minute, the court order requirement was tacked on. And that's how we got to the point where we are now. We would like to, at least in narcotics cases, go back to the pre-1985 law, because typically you don't have all of the advance warning. That's the reasoning for it.
May I ask one further question?
Yes.
Thank you. Under current law, if I had a device on me right now and I was recording our conversation, would that be an offense?
Here?
Well, let's say in the hallway.
Yes. If you did,
I'd have to advise you specifically that I was recording the conversation.
That's correct, and that's the reason that we need this statute to apply to the situation.
So when we had a legislative tour by freshman legislators of the state penitentiary, and at least two of those legislators were carrying body wire mics for television cameramen, is that something different?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Read the statute.
How far does this law go?
Okay. Well, you read the statute. It's very interesting. It's new. Reasonably should have known that the particular circumstance to be recorded. But there are a lot of exceptions to
okay.
public meetings and news conferences.
Mr. Chairman.
That type of thing. It's fairly broad.
Mr. Chairman.
So, Representative Bauman had a question on the prior bill, and I somehow got around that. Representative Bauman, you had a question on 2251, I believe.
Yes, I did. I was just sitting
so if we
here.
Can just, I apologize to the audience members for shifting back.
You don't mind. I was trying to shift gears from my question to the 2252, but I do have a question. Actually, I'm curious if in your studying of the impact of FOINDER, you took into account impact on the settlement of multiple charges that currently occurs between prosecutors and defense attorneys, and whether the additional expense in both time and court resources has been actually a positive motivation in encouraging settlement of multiple offenses, which ultimately reduces the number of trials, and whether this would then possibly in actual greater number of trials.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bauman, if I might respond to that, simply because it came up last session, and the statistics that you have there about fiscal impact or bar statistics or Marion County statistics, that is very difficult to predict. However, I am not hiding the fact that this is a tool for the prosecution. It is an advantage to the prosecution to be able to join all in one instrument, and it is a tool for the defense under present law to be able to split into smaller increments, divide and conquer. I believe, and certainly what I've been told by federal prosecutors, is there is much more motivation for a defendant to plead guilty if that defendant knows that there will be all the charges in one trial. And I believe that there will be less trials with this joinder device. How many is purely speculation, but I think that comes down to the precise issue. The defense objects to it because it will remove a weapon that they have. The prosecution wants it because it will assist, and we believe it will be more cost effective. And my response is that it is fair And it is not an improper advantage to the prosecution because it is federal law. And it has been on the books for years and years, and it is the law in other jurisdictions, and at no place has it been determined to be unconstitutional or unfair. It is now a costly advantage that we provide to a criminal defendant in the state of Oregon that I do not believe that we can afford to pay for.
Other questions?
If I might add to that, let's keep in mind it's the defendant's choice as to whether or not they want to plea bargain or change their plea. Their attorney may well advise them that it's in their best interest, but it's the defendant's choice. I have a very current example. I have a case next month with seven different trials with the same defendant, three different theft charges, theft in the first degree, four different forgery in the first degree. These cases have carried over for several years because this defendant is in custody, then matrixed out, and is arrested once again. And now we're finally here for all seven trials. This defendant intends to go to trial, to my knowledge, on each of the cases. It may also be the type of defendant that the prosecution may not want to offer a deal to, so to speak. But anyway, we're looking at, in the forgery cases, the same victim in every single case, but it's a different date or different time, therefore it may not be properly joined. They've been severed. There'll be four different trials, each about a day in length, each costing the indigent defense fund approximately $300. Each theft case is complex, will take 2 or 3 days, $600 or $900 per case. The same five officers in each theft case, but two different victims in each theft case. So we're looking at seven different trials, compounding several thousand dollars when it could be in one trial because they're similar.
Thank you very much. Nothing further questions. I want to move on to 2252. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Peter Shepherd, Oregon Department of Justice on 2252. This is the body wire bill part.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Peter Shepherd. I'm here from the Oregon Department of Justice, and the department supports House Bill 2252. This measure is a priority item for the Law Enforcement Legislative Committee. The membership of that committee includes the Department of Justice, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association, the Oregon Sheriff's Association, the Oregon State Police, and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. Mr. Chairman, I've submitted some written testimony, and I'll rely principally on that. I do want to lay out for the committee one hypothetical situation that illustrates an inconsistency in the current law that's frankly very difficult to explain in my role as an advisor to police officers. It arises out of, or could arise under these facts. An undercover police officer, Paul, telephones a drug dealer, Dan, and surreptitiously records that telephone conversation. During the course of that conversation, Dan says, "I'm a drug dealer and I have a lot of cocaine in my closet." At the same time, there's an undercover police officer, Peter, in the room with Dan, and he secretly tape records that end of the conversation. Paul's tape recording is admissible because in Oregon, all one needs is one party consent to a telephone call, and the tape is admissible. Peter's tape recording is inadmissible, and Peter is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor for secretly recording that conversation without having a court order. Now, this is an inconsistency that's very difficult to explain, and I would suggest is one reason why House Bill 2252 ought to be adopted by this committee and by the legislature.
Question, Mr. Shepherd. Thank you very much. John Reichel, Bicep County Sheriff.
I'm John Reichel, Sheriff of Clatsop County. I'd like to discuss real briefly that there's a mandate by the public, state and federal governments for law enforcement to be more effective with curbing the flow of illicit drug trafficking. One of the major tools I feel that would help law enforcement is this particular bill. I'm a sheriff of a rather small county, and therefore I act both as an administrator and occasionally as an investigator doing street-level drug investigation. As an administrator, I cringe every time I have to send a deputy into a situation where for a period of time he's going to be without any support from the rest of his peers and an unknown situation with the danger involved. Many of the cases that we've taken out in Clatsop County is just a small outtake of what's going on throughout Oregon. Most of the major drug operations we've taken out, we've seized many automatic weapons, and I think that officer safety is highly justified in these instances. As an investigator, we also know that the most effective way for law enforcement to utilize drug investigations that they have currently available is the use of informants. We have an obligation when we turn an informant to help law enforcement out, to provide some type of safety for that informant also. Also, the integrity of the informant's statements that he makes to us, if it's recorded, is going to be much higher than those that are just done when we have to rely on the information we get from him when he comes back out. I feel that the body wire itself being concealed, and the only way it is effective is for it to be concealed, and you don't want the people that are being investigated to know you're carrying it, that there is nothing there to solicit any type of evidence that normally would not be coming out from those persons anywhere. There's nothing in the body wire that would enhance somebody to give you testimony or give you evidence that you normally don't have. We send officers off so that they can be more effective in narcotics investigation to federal schools. Oregon is one of the exceptions of it. What they learn in the federal schools or from the DEA schools, they come back to Oregon and we tell them that what you learn there you cannot use in Oregon because Oregon is different. I would greatly urge supporting of a bill that would put Oregon in line with the rest of the United States.
Questions to Sheriff Frank? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Walter Todd again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Walter Todd, I'm a defense lawyer in Salem representing the OCDLA, and the OCDLA is opposed to this bill. Very briefly, I'd like to respond to Mr. Shepard's hypothetical, if I could. The reason I believe that an individual is faced with this situation, a telephone conversation versus an in-person conversation, is that the person on the telephone has less of an expectation of privacy in his conversation than an individual who's in a room talking to another individual face to face. That's the decision that has been made in the past in any event, and I think that's a valid decision. Certainly someone on the telephone realizes that the conversation has to go through an operator, that there may be extensions, that sort of thing. I mean, the Constitution recognizes that individuals have expectations of privacy, that there should be some safeguards to that. And I see no reason given why an officer of the court, in other words, a judge, can't make a decision on that as a safeguard to the officer's decision. Now, Mr. Penn's talked about the time it takes, and I would represent to you, Mr. Chair, and the committee, that most officers now have their affidavits for search warrant on computer. A lot of the officers who do the drug work have little lab computers, and they have all of the standard phrases required for an affidavit in order to show probable cause for the search warrant on this computer. There are only about two blanks left on the computer. The officer gets the information, prints it into those two blanks, affidavit is printed out, he goes to a judge, whatever judge is available, indicates to the judge that here's the affidavit, he swears to the truth of it, judge gives the search warrant. The time lapse factor, not a justification for overlooking that safeguard where a court can look at it and say, here's what's going on. There's probable cause in the court's mind for this wire, and we'll go ahead and do it. Why not have that safeguard? If the only justification is the time lapse, that's been overcome by the computer age, if you will. And I don't believe also that there's any statistical information to show any correlation between the pre-85, when we had the other law that allows the body wire without a court order, and post-85 to show that somehow there are more arrests or more convictions as a result of it. The committee would need that.
Good question, Mr. Todd. Representative Clark.
I'm kind of curious about technology considerations here. You're talking about laptop computers, and you're talking about placing phone calls through operators. Tell me about that. What kind of phone calls get placed through operators nowadays?
Well, yeah. I'm not up on telephone technology. I'm just saying that an individual making a phone call could assume, I think, that operators can listen in on it. I don't know whether Bell has that capacity or not, but I think people making those phone calls might make that assumption.
The last Bell operator, God knows where she is.
12 years ago.
Same place as the last elevator operator.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
public service industry heaven. Go ahead.
Mr. Todd, have you ever personally observed these affidavits that are in a computer system being used by drug units?
For search warrants for houses, yes, I have.
You have. Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question.
You want the software representative? Go ahead.
Have you yourself ever put one of these search warrants together and taken it to a judge and asked a judge to review it and sign it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Minnis, yes, I have, when I was in the district attorney's office.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question. Is it your experience that judges generally read these documents?
Well,